From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, one police chief on what it will take to win back public trust.
You know, you could say community policing, but when they see a person lose their lives on a video within 9 minutes, they want to see where this change is taking place.
His department is retraining for de-escalation. More coming up. Also, a systemic study of the Muslim experience from politics to racial profiling.
It really doesn't matter if you choose to say, I am white or I am Middle Eastern. It's really how the public classifies you that matters.
And Detroit's Plowshares Theater buckles down for the long haul and the urgent work of Black storytelling.
If we let go of that responsibility, we abandon the very reason why artists are so vital, the very purpose of why we exist.
Those stories and more just ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today we're going to touch base with the director of Plowshares Theater in Detroit about the role of Black art articulating what's happening in the streets right now. That conversation is coming up later in the program, but first, the weekend posed next-level challenges to police departments who've already had a tough road adapting to the challenges of policing during the COVID-19 era. Protests over police use of force are not new to Michigan's law enforcement, but the intersection of protests with pandemic and the ensuing losses in the community adds a lot of layers. Tony Holt is the chief of the Wayne State University Police Department. He's been involved in police work for about 45 years. Chief Holt, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Tell us what the weekend was like for your district.
You know, we're in the heart of Midtown, and all of our officers are sworn Detroit police officers also. So not only do we take care of the campus area community, but we take care of the historical district like Woodbridge, the cultural center, and the Midtown area around the campus. So we respond to quite a few requests for services. Where there are major events going on downtown and elsewhere, then we join in and we will assist Detroit police, and we're part of the response to those events.
Yeah.
So this weekend has been very challenging.
Can you say about how many of your officers got called in to help out?
Well, last night, for example, I had six officers and myself downtown working with Detroit police. I would like to say that protest is a method of change. My father has been involved in a protest in the early 60s with Martin Luther King. I've seen protests, and that's when things get done. So I want to make it clear that Wayne State Police is not here to curb protests. I look at it as we want to make sure people have their right to protest, and we want to make sure the protest doesn't take a turn where it becomes destruction of property and people, especially police, getting injured and citizens.
Chief, as we've mentioned, you've been doing this job for 4 decades now. What were your thoughts on what we saw over the weekend compared with people in the street in years past?
Well, I think now you have a much, much larger coalition of people coming in and protest. You know, this is not strictly just the neighborhood or people in the city coming in. You have protesters coming in from out of town. We have a large, it's the most diverse protest I've ever seen in quite a long time. I worked at Chrysler's years ago when the League of Revolutionary Workers was formed. And it's pretty much an all-African-American group. This is a real diverse group of people coming protesting. And the difference with this protest, they want change and they want it right now. They want it 5 minutes ago.
Yeah. The Wayne State University Police Department has taken on a project to become a national de-escalation training center. Can you tell us about what this project means and how it's changing the work that you're doing?
Well, it's a big change. It changes the use of force continuum where we start and where we escalate to. Now we're at the very beginning stage. We want to do a de-escalation. This is not a typical de-escalation where you let a person vent and you talk them out of it. This is a very basic scientific method where it's based on personality traits. And then out of these four major personality traits, there are about 26 subcategories where we try to get train the officers to recognize the person as an individual. It's not a one-size-fits-all de-escalation. It's not the type of de-escalation where you're going, okay, the person's upset, we let them vent, we let them run around, and we say, that's okay, we walk away. This is where we take steps to understand what the situation is and how we could de-escalate that situation where it does not come to a physical use of force to stop that.
One of the cornerstones of police training is the idea that officers need to maintain a certain amount of command presence. That's, I guess, the term of art, you'd say, that you see in academies. Do de-escalation principles in any way conflict with other kinds of training that your officers receive to try to maintain control?
Yeah, I think it's going to change that type of behavior. You know, we're starting at the low end. And we're hoping with this de-escalation, you do not have to escalate to the next step. You have to maintain a level of control for your own safety and the safety of those around you. But you want to let the person know, now I understand what kind of problems you have, and you can see by the personality standard and the subsets of these categories individually what this person is going through, and to help you to understand what those next steps are to take. You're right. It does change the traditional matter where you go in with this, where you let the person know, I'm in control, I'm running this, and you're going to do as I say, and you're going to do it now. That's going to change that sort of concept. And I think the academies themselves are teaching de-escalation, and that old theory of the type of police officer walk in, everybody be quiet, I'm running this is what we're going to do. I think that's been moving away from that direction for years.
At the same time, and not speaking so much to what Wayne State Police have shown, but we are still in a place in this country where a great many officers are aware of eyes of the public on them with respect to how they are using force. How long does it take to undo the training and the traditions by which policing have been conducted here?
Oh, I don't know if it's going to really take that long right now. If you look at what just happened, and you look at what you're dealing with the public, everyone has some sort of cameras. There's this video around. Officers are wearing body cams, their dash cams in the car. If this doesn't have an effect in you as an officer, then you really need to turn in that badge. You have to realize that the way that you react to what you saw on television and that video, you can't do that.
Right.
You know. Now, it's all sorts of training that police go through. That's probably 100 different type of training that you'll see all the time. But the question is, in this type of training, you're going to have to get buy-in with the officers and say, this is a cultural change here. This is what we're doing. This is how the way we go to police. And policing and training and buy-in is a top-down matter. You have to, the officers have to know that the leadership of the department and the leadership of who the department reports to, this is the direction we're going in. And you have to get buy-in because it's from the top down.
How difficult is it to try to implement such a fundamental principle at a time when the larger area of Detroit that Wayne State University Police are a part of is going through this serious period of civil unrest? I mean, are those principles still relevant when folks are out in the street?
Oh, yeah, this is when it has to start. Yeah, the timing could not be better for this to start, because you're dealing with an angry crowd out right here. There's a distrust of law enforcement, and they're responding to what they've seen on a video. Not that one incident. They're talking about a historical perspective of what they've seen. They're looking at this and saying, wait a minute, we're going back to Rodney King, and this is still going on? So this is excellent training for the officer. As an excellent opportunity for the public who we have contact to say, well, no, we're coming towards you with a different perspective. Mm-hmm. It's going to be difficult because we're dealing with a very tension-filled, upset public, which is rightfully so.
You mentioned that there are things that you can say to officers about how they're, you know, how scrutiny demands this in the moment right now. Are there things you can also say to them about how this might help them do their jobs better?
Oh, absolutely. This is a method of obtaining trust by the community and obtaining buy-in by the community. And I think the timing is good because it's going to cause you to work extra hard to get that buy-in. And this is not an overnight. You're not going to build trust overnight by having these one-on-ones encounter. The community and the citizens want to see this in action. You know, you could say community policing, but when they see a person lose their lives on a video within 9 minutes, they want to see where this change is taking place and how you approach them and how you police.
Anyone who's had a chance to observe police in action has probably seen some form of de-escalation technique, but can you tell us anything else about what people might expect, what's going to look different in the years to come if de-escalation is fully put into practice?
Yeah, I think what you're going to see is you're going to see a different response. I'm speaking by our agencies, the agencies we'll be involved with. I think you'll see a different response when you call the police. I think you'll see more of a shared response where we're going to try to do a little more understanding of what the situation is. It's not going to be the simple reason, okay, we're here now, you walk away and cool off and don't have us come back here again. I think you'll see a completely different approach. I think you'll see an approach where we will recognize that it might be a mental health issue and we might need to get you assistance on a mental health issue. You might see us approach where we say, you know, this is an issue of what you don't have. You're not eating properly. You don't have access to this part of the system, and we need to do that. You might see an approach where on a traffic stop we approach you, and you might say, no, I'm not giving you my license, and I'm not getting out the car. And you might not say, okay, you have 30 seconds to do this, or we're going to take you to the next level. I think you'll see a discussion more of why you're stopped, why you're angry, and what this stop is about.
Chief Tony Holt leads the Wayne State University Police Force. Chief Holt, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, a data-driven look at the shifting social and political experiences of Muslim Americans over the past 20 years. An MSU assistant professor talks to us about her work and her new book after the break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. America's fundamental narrative tells us that anyone can come to the States, take part in community, prosperity, and upward mobility if they believe in freedom. But the reality lived by millions of Americans of color is that that narrative is somewhat less true for Americans who don't look Caucasian or who practice religions other than Christianity. Michigan State University assistant professor Nazita Lajavardi has written a new book exploring the experiences of Muslim Americans. It's called Outsiders at Home, and she joins us today. Nazita, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Your book explores the experience of Muslims in America through some personal details, but primarily through data. Why did that feel important?
Yeah, I mean, it feels important because while we know a lot anecdotally about Muslims facing discrimination in the United States, you don't have to go too far back in history to remember, you know, how political elites linked them with 9/11 after those attacks, mm-hmm. Thinking through the widespread surveillance programs and prolonged detentions. There's also been a rise in anti-Muslim incidents, as well as, you know, anti-Sharia laws that are being introduced and even enacted in a lot of states. We can even think, obviously, through the 2016 election, where presidential candidates not only frequently raised them in debates and made them visible, but they also endorsed policies that would target the group and continue to isolate them. And then finally, we've had a Muslim ban, right? So we have a number of different pieces of evidence that tell us that, at least anecdotally, there's something up. But unless we can measure it, and unless we can show that this group is facing discrimination in a number of different ways, that is political, that shows that there are systematic differences in the quality of representation, then we don't really have a leg to stand on, right? So these just all become anecdotes. And so I thought it was very important for us to be able to show that what we perceive as being true is in fact happening, and to show the many dimensions in which political discrimination manifests against this population.
You begin with some history and talk about the fact that for a long time, Middle Eastern immigrants to the United States, many of whom were Muslim, were often considered white for all practical legal purposes. Could you talk a little bit about that policy and when and how it ended?
Sure, yeah. So it's actually quite interesting, and I think people often forget that, you know, in the late 1800s and early 1900s, there was a struggle for naturalization. And naturalization was limited to white persons determined by the courts. And of course, naturalization was important for a number of different outcomes, such as voting, of course, first and foremost, but also for property ownership even. And so Middle Easterners also were part of this movement to gain naturalization rights. And in doing so, many of them were actually granted privileges of whiteness, especially with the 1915 Dow versus United States case. This was a case involving a Syrian man where the courts in that case granted privileges of whiteness to Syrians, Parsis, and different individuals from various nationalities. So why I bring this up in the book is because I think it's very important to contextualize that this is a group that is incredibly diverse. For instance, about half are immigrants and born abroad, about 25% are African American. And so when you think of that different diversity, these individuals were granted privileges of membership in the polity at different times, but now they're all being excluded according to their Muslim background.
Yeah. You also spend a lot of time writing about the fact that since September 11th, there has been a degree of pan-Muslim identity that has taken root both sort of within scholarly circles and in how some Muslims think about their own place in the community. Even though historically there have been plenty of reasons why, for example, Americans whose families come from different Muslim countries or who might follow different Sunni or Shi'i traditions, they might not see things the same way. For the purposes of federal law enforcement, those differences might be a moot point. Tell us about the consequences to the whole question of pan-Muslim identity for people in America.
Sure. So, you know, we often talk about pan-ethnic identities. And what we mean by that is, how does the public view you? What group do they think you belong to? And so it really doesn't matter if you choose to say, I am white, or I am Middle Eastern. It's really how the public classifies you that matters. And so with Muslims, what's really fascinating is that there are individuals out there, such as Sikhs, for instance, such as Arab Christians, right, who at first glance may appear to the public as being Muslim because of the tropes that they see being communicated to them. They may not, for instance, see a Congress member like Andre Carson and label him as Muslim. How the public views Muslims actually has quite racialized them. And, you know, I'm aware that these, you know, we're talking about a religious group and I just used a word that had the word racial in there. But racialization is a process whereby groups are inherently labeled as inferior. They're collectively classified without really much control over that identity group. They're often labeled as being disloyal. And I think it's consequential because it matters for how the public treats them. It matters for how legislators treat them. It matters if, for instance, somebody perceives a candidate who's running for office as being Muslim. It matters that they're racialized, even if perhaps the candidate is not, and they just, for instance, have an Arabic-sounding name. I think it's very important to think through the consequences of racialization and this pan-ethnic identity in terms of their political treatment and positionality.
I can't tell you how sad I was when I got to the part of the book that has a chapter entitled Introducing the Muslim American Resentment Scale. Can you, again, as we said, this was part of the point of the book, was to talk about quantifying the anecdotal things that Muslims in America may experience. Can you talk about what kind of measurements the scale involves?
Sure. So the Muslim American Resentment Scale is a series of 9 different statements, stereotypical statements, that ask individuals about how much they agree or disagree with the statements. For instance, most Muslim Americans integrate successfully into American culture. Or Muslim Americans sometimes do not have the best interests of Americans at heart. Or most Muslim Americans are not terrorists. And essentially, these 9 items, I've argued in a number of papers that they actually capture really specific stereotypes and prejudices towards Muslim Americans. What was happening before I developed the scale was that individuals were taking a set of items about African Americans and they were saying, look, this predicts policy support about Muslims. Look, this is about Muslims. And I just didn't really think that was fully capturing the specificity of the bias that existed in the mass public. And so the purpose of this scale is really to understand whether or not there are specific predictors of mass attitudes towards Muslim Americans that are shaping individuals' policy support, their candidate support, and essentially their voter behavior even.
If you're just joining us, my guest is MSU professor Nazita Lajavardi. She's the author of a new book, Outsiders at Home. It's a data-driven look at the experiences of Muslims in the U.S. When Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar were elected to Congress in 2016, it felt like an exhalation to a lot of people who had been waiting to see more representation, who were looking for a sign that a political acceptance of Muslim candidates could indeed happen. What are some of the things you've observed about the way that they've moved through mainstream politics and the way that they've used their pulpits and just sort of how the party's leadership has interacted with them?
It's interesting because now we have on the center stage 2 Muslim women, one of whom is of Arab descent, one of whom is of African descent, one of whom is an immigrant, one of whom wears a hijab. And so there is this interaction between a gender identity and a religious identity and a racial identity that's happening in a way that doesn't really manifest for the male Muslim members of Congress.
Not to mention a political identity.
Right, and a political identity, exactly. And so before, when we were studying Muslim candidates, we really only could look at Keith Ellison and Andre Carson and look at, okay, do they have bias against the Muslim community? Do they advertise themselves as being Muslim? But their Muslim identities, they could choose whether or not to engage that because their names are not Muslim sounding. I'm putting that in air quotes. Mm-hmm. They don't, wear, religious garb. So it's less obvious to the public that these individuals may be Muslim. On the flip side, you have 2 women who sort of entered the political stage during the Year of the Woman, and they have taken up a lot of attention. And so if you look at the disproportionate amount of weight that's being attributed to them, especially by Republicans and especially by the president, it serves to reinforce the fact that these women are consistently being racialized. At the same time, their identities are part of what makes individuals connect to them, right? That's part of what draws their supporters to them.
You spent some time talking about the fact that the Democratic left, which at one point was sort of a natural ally for Muslim voters, has oftentimes not really lived up to voters' expectations, and that, in fact, there was a time not that long ago when Republicans were pretty actively courting Muslim voters in Michigan and other places. What do you think is holding back candidates in 2020, in this modern time, from making a more public pitch to Muslim voters?
So on the one hand, we don't actually know how many Muslim voters there are. And this is because the U.S. Census doesn't collect data on religion. So legislators don't even know who they need to mobilize. They don't even know how many there are to mobilize. And estimates of the population range from 2 million to 15 million. So if we don't really know how many Muslims there are in America, and we think it's pretty small of a percentage, then maybe we can ignore them. Maybe they're just a captured vote, and maybe they can be ignored in politics. If your constituents who have, a lot of Muslim American resentment are aware of the fact that you're privileging Muslims, that you're recruiting Muslims, that you're campaigning to them, well, then you might face a backlash and you're not quite sure how many Muslims are going to get out to vote for you anyways. So
at the same time, you point out that Muslims represent a significant population in many of the swing states, including Michigan.
Right, right. Yeah, it's phenomenal because it's a calculus. And it actually, in one of the studies in my book, I find that Democrats sort of throughout the country, they discriminate against Muslims. But in the states where there's a large Muslim population, there's actually a little bit of hope. Both Republicans and Democrats do a little bit to try to recruit them. So there is a positive spin.
Muslim Americans are not politically homogenous. How do you interpret some of the ways that they've reacted to the heightened visibility that they experience in day-to-day life and how that's reflected in their politics?
Yeah, they're absolutely not uniform. I think when asked at the current time, most Muslims would report voting for a Democratic candidate just because they've been so ostracized by the Republican Party. But if you just go back to 2000, to the year 2000, that was a time where Muslims actually tried to mobilize behind George Bush. If you just look at what happened in just 20 years, it's pretty phenomenal to see how they were pushed away from one party to another. They're a group that at the moment, I think they're, if they do vote, if they do participate, they're going to be solidly behind the Democratic Party. And that's simply because of they have nowhere else to go. But in terms of how conservative their values are, there's certainly room for Republicans to try to create a policy agenda that would appeal to them.
What did you learn through all of the statistical work that you did in the book? Do you feel like you learned anything about what it would take to help reduce the resentment, as the index puts it, toward Muslims?
Yeah, so I'd like to point out that I think media coverage matters a lot. And what we see sort of happening over time is that the media is talking about Muslims kind of generally and African Americans and Latinos at very, very high rates in its coverage. And I'm talking mostly about CNN, Fox, and MSNBC. These three cable news outlets are featuring these groups at very, very high rates. And on top of that, when they are featured, Muslims come out on bottom and they're not doing so well. What's been really encouraging is that I find that at different time periods, positive coverage can actually reduce resentment. And that gives me a lot of hope that if we are able to create news content that is more positive and is not sort of overstating the negative attributes about stigmatized groups, then we might actually see some changes in the mass public's opinions and perhaps treatments of one another.
You know, I wondered about your own experience with this. Your folks came to the United States from Iran, and I wondered what you had observed of their own sense of themselves as Americans and just sort of what your own experience had been with this over the years.
Yeah, so, you know, I was raised in a somewhat religious Muslim family. And my parents immigrated here in the 70s as students before the revolution, and they were excluded from their home country because once the revolution happened, they couldn't return. They were still continuing their studies. And so I was sort of raised with sort of understanding, you know, what hard work was, but I never really understood what exclusion felt like until 9/11. My parents became so frightened after the United States invaded Iraq after they had already invaded Afghanistan, because Iran is situated specifically in the middle of those two countries, and they felt that, okay, Iran is next, and they've just been labeled the axis of evil. And so what does that mean? And so they actually went out and they purchased a home abroad in a different country, thinking, you know, we don't want to be members of a polity where they're going to go and, you know, bomb our home country. And so for a long time, they held on to that property, and they really worked to make it home because they were so scared. And I think that was the first time I really understood, you know, what citizenship meant to them. It wasn't, they didn't feel American. And so I began to doubt if I was American. And it really manifested for me after the 2016 presidential campaign when the Muslim ban was enacted. I was devastated. I never thought this would ever happen. And my mom sort of turned to me and said, well, what did you expect? You know, when we became citizens, they made us sign a paper that said, you know, that we are aware that our citizenship could be revoked. And I had no idea that that was even possible. And I'm a lawyer. It's just, it was sort of shocking to me. It was a rather strong critique of her membership in the American polity and of what it meant to her to be an American. She always felt like her identity was being held hostage. And so I think over the time, their experiences, as well as my own experiences, have made me question, you know, how do I feel American? What makes me feel American? And I believe in the Constitution, not in, of course, the realities that have happened in the United States and its history, but the words on the page. I think they've given and they've breathed life to a form of democracy that's imperfect, of course, and is exclusionary, of course, but it still worked to further things. And so I think that's kind of what makes me still feel American and hold on to that identity.
Nizita Lajavardi's new book is called Outsiders at Home. It's an examination of the experiences of Muslims in America. She's an assistant professor at Michigan State University. Nizita, thank you for the book and for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Art is supposed to provoke difficult conversations. That doesn't change during a time of pandemic and social unrest.
But if we let go of that responsibility, we abandon the very reason why artists are so vital to our civilization. We abandon the very purpose of why we exist.
Detroit's Plowshares Theater artistic director Gary Anderson talks about what he's programming next on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan's performing arts groups are grappling with how social distancing during the COVID-19 pandemic will affect production seasons, both now and into the fall and beyond. At the same time, many ensembles are trying to devise some new ways to stay connected with their audiences. For Plowshares Theater Company, an African-American organization in Detroit, this challenging national moment also emphasizes why creative communities, perhaps now more than ever, need Black storytelling. With us is Gary Anderson. He's producing artistic director of Plowshares and also the creator of a new podcast called Black Theater Matters. Gary Anderson, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You know, the last time we spoke, you were in rehearsal for this Vanguard production and looking forward to the rest of the season. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what's happened for Plowshares since then?
Well, we were about to go into rehearsal with a world premiere of a brand new play that we were very excited about, Roost by Lee Edward Colson II. And the governor put in her executive order, which was to shut down all operations in the state roughly on the 23rd of March, basically 7 days before we were supposed to go in rehearsal. And that meant that we had to postpone everything at that point, not knowing when or if we were going to be able to mount the show. And now, June 1st, it's clear to us that we're not going to be able to do the show anytime within the next 7-8 months. So we're at this point starting to look at mounting live performances in front of an audience no earlier than February of 2021, or actually in spring of 2021, basically a year from now.
Wow. I mean, for those who don't know, ticket revenue is not a small part of the economics of any live theater.
Right.
In as much as live theaters also have a great need of their individual donors and the philanthropic community, mm-hmm. but that's devastating, basically no revenue until winter 2021.
Well, we're going to begin a campaign actually this week to solicit contributions over the next several months for programming that we are going to be able to do. It took me a while to sit down and think about it, but my desire for how we move forward in this new altered state was to try to solve two problems. Solve the continued need of telling Black stories, and at the same time, also solve the greater need of building an audience and making those connections between audience members and the artists on an ongoing basis. And so I've come up with several different programs designed to put our art online in an attempt to try to continue those connections and in an attempt to try to maintain our connection to both our audience and our artists who desperately need opportunities to work.
Well, I want to ask you more about what you have in mind in terms of content, mm-hmm. but let me first ask about the artists that you just mentioned. You know, the artist's life is pretty precarious under the best of circumstances. How are your collaborators doing these days?
Well, in many cases, a lot of them are challenged because they saw on an immediate basis all employment that they had booked completely eliminated. And so I've had a number of artists who, you know, are on some form of unemployment or they're looking for assistance in some other fashion. At the same time, also trying to create programming that potentially could get them employed, which many organizations are struggling with. I mean, this has been devastating for the arts and cultural community because in many cases, that was the original gig economy. When you think about it, an actor, a director, designer, whomever, has to put together several jobs in a year to give them enough revenue to live off of. And at any point in time in that precarious balance, when one of those projects falls out, you find that they have to immediately replace it with something else, even if it does mean going to a regular 9-to-5 job. In this situation, all of those opportunities are taken off the table for them. And so they don't have a way of getting another arts-related job. And at the same time, they don't really have any opportunities in really getting employment in a regular 9-to-5 position. And so you have a group of people for whom every source of income has been eliminated for them. And that becomes extremely challenging.
So this is any commercials they might have booked, teaching gigs, or just work in other kinds of fields.
Exactly. Yeah, there might be a workshop that they could conduct, or in-school residency they could have done, or they could have gone back to waiting tables or selling insurance or doing real estate, whatever they had an additional skill set. But again, those things are also taken away from them.
What kind of content have you thought about producing in this period when in-person performances to a full house just aren't even possible?
Well, the content hasn't changed. It's actually heightened the importance of the work that we were doing. One of the aspects of Plowshares has been our play development and programming. In fact, we've been very proud at the fact that we developed a relationship on the development of new work. In the show I came to talk to you about earlier this year was a work that I had been developing with the playwright 2 years, 18 months. So we've created a program called Play On, where we're taking a lot of the scripts that had been sent to us in an option to put their readings online. So I'm going to be hiring actors to play the parts where they're going to record themselves. We're going to take all that and we're going to present that online in a live presentation on a regular schedule. The schedule is going to be announced later this week.
Wow.
Along with the plays. And the idea is that we'll also provide an opportunity for our audience who connects into it to be able to make comments, to give their observations, just as they would have if they were sitting in a theater watching it.
So it's sort of like an online workshop for the work?
Yeah. The idea is to create the opportunity for the work that we are devoted to that is actually part of our mission to be maintained in this circumstance.
Is it possible for playwrights to react to the moment fast enough to maybe think about forms of narrative that would work in that kind of online venue?
In some cases, speed is not our friend in the creation of art. It's important that a writer hear what is being presented to them as a reaction to their work and sit with that for a moment to process it and then respond in how they may choose to revise or not revise the work, or how they look at emphasizing certain things. I've worked with writers where comments both from myself and from a moderated audience has not necessarily seen changes modified in the specific area that we were discussing. But what happened was that the artist process that information, and they may have made developments across the field where some of the perspectives that were presented might have found themselves in the mouths of a character who didn't respond to the circumstances in the play prior to that. So there's a whole host of ways in which you can create the kind of environment you're looking for to provide the artist with the information that they need to respond to. And in the final analysis, I keep trying to say this because I've learned this too. In the final analysis, the play is the property of the playwright. I can be very passionate about what I think a writer can change, but that writer has to be confident that this is still their voice, even when they hear the comments of other artists.
My guest today is Gary Anderson, the producing artistic director of Plowshares Theater Company in Detroit. I have to say, I mean, I know this kind of interpretation is part of the job, but it sounds like a huge lift for a director to reinterpret work in a way that's going to mean something in the format that we're presenting right now.
It is extremely important for us to not forget what the charge of the artist is. We have a responsibility to basically heal civilization through how we bring up ideas and express points of view and perspective, even when we open up the dialogue for very frustrating and challenging conversations. That has not been abandoned because of our current circumstances. In fact, if the last week has taught us nothing else, it's made it very clear that there have been unheard people and unseen people in this country and across this planet that are demanding to be heard, demanding to be seen, and demanding that change occur. And I understand it's not easy, but if we let go of that responsibility, we abandon the very reason why artists are so vital to our civilization. We abandon the very purpose of why we exist.
The theater has always been a place where people can sit with truths by virtue of the fact that when they go to a play, they cannot simply switch off the screen. You know, they cannot switch to a different stream of social media.
Right.
There's an intimacy to the work that, you know, some people would argue really beats, you know, even some of the most powerful treatments that we've seen in film and streaming cinema in recent years. But at the same time, it really does rely on what you're saying for people to buy the ticket or, you know, tune into the stream in the mid-pandemic stage. Are you finding that people are coming to Plowshares for that right now, or that different audience members are coming right now for that?
That is our hope, and that is our effort. That's how our marketing strategy is designed, around people being aware of the fact that what we do is unique and critical. It's not just simply entertainment. We are finding that we're both soliciting and receiving support from audience members that we would not have naturally seen in our theater or supporting our work beforehand, which is good because that means that we're starting to do the work that we need to help our civilization heal. But we need to do more of it. We need to expand upon it. We need to continue to build on this and not stop. And our current circumstance does not give us the right to sit down and wait until everything is over. We have the opportunity to begin doing that healing now and making those connections now. But people have to be willing. The will is so critical at this point. The will is so critical. We have to have the artists willing to actually engage and bring their best talents to bear. We have to have the audience equally willing to bear and bring their open minds to hearing the message that is being presented.
In the midst of everything else that you're doing right now, you're also in development for a podcast, a new podcast called Black Theater Matters, as we mentioned. In the course of researching what kind of things you needed to talk about, what patterns did you see happening in Black theaters across the United States?
About 4 years ago, I was able to get a Kresge Artist Fellowship. It provided me with time and resources to go around the country and study the circumstances that other African-American theaters existed in. My original plan was to develop a business plan for the theater based on the best practices and models that I found around the country. And I did an extensive culling of what Black-led arts organizations across this country there were. And I was able to compile that. And then I began to do personal trips to several different regions. I went to New York, Chicago, Atlanta, Memphis, St. Louis, LA, and Portland, Oregon. And I stayed in contact over the line with other artists in Houston, in Virginia, in other parts of the country. And what I found was that a number of the challenges I've had, regardless of the size or the longevity or the stability of the organization, we were all dealing with similar circumstances. There was a real dearth in individual giving to African-American theaters around this country. The average across the predominantly white institutions, you can see it range anywhere between 25 to 30%, sometimes almost up to 42% of their operating budget comes from individual giving. For African-American theaters, the vast majority of those, it was less than 10%. There were only a handful that were doing better than that. That's a real statement, not necessarily of the support of the value that your community has, but the investment that your community has in your organization. In many cases, the funding culture's commitment over the last 30 years to different forms of diversity programming to support diversity in regional white theaters, like equity inclusion initiatives, cultural participation initiatives that was designed on getting large white theaters to integrate their boards, their staffs, their programming, had really not had any impact at all. That basically in 1989, before all this began, the majority of people in the arts community, in the theater community, the jobs that were being made were basically given away to whites, 78%. In 2016, when I did my work, it was roughly the same. It had not changed that much over almost a 30-year period. So that all these dollars that were invested in white institutions to diversify themselves had not changed culture or behavior or attitudes. There may have been some cosmetic differences, but it wasn't appreciable to make the difference that the funding community claimed that they were trying to support. At the same time, in many cases, African-American theaters, Hispanic, Latino, Native American theaters, Asian theaters found themselves being challenged in regards to being able to receive the same dollars for the same purpose, to diversify their audience, to diversify their boards, because for some reason, the initiative was designed only to serve the largest white institutions as they were going through changes in regards to their audiences. The majority of their audience dying off, younger audiences not being built at a sufficient amount to support these organizations. And so that all was impacting everybody in the entire Black theater community in some capacity. And I started seeing that with Black writers, Black talent going to work maybe as their first or second job in predominantly white institutions, that there was a talent drain across the Black theater community. I also saw that if you get all these funding sources that are coming, that are being reduced, if you've got talent pool that's being reduced, yet the need for your voice to be heard is still critical. You find yourself in a situation where your very survival is being impacted. And so the podcast is really designed to address those larger systemic issues, to begin a dialogue for us to start thinking about these issues and how we affect change for the positive.
We've been talking today with Gary Anderson of Plowshares Theater Company based in Detroit. His new podcast is Black Theater Matters, and you can look to the Plowshares Facebook page to stay up on productions that are happening online and in other ways in months to come. Gary Anderson, it's good to hear your voice, and thanks for joining us today.
All right, you take it easy.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Barth. Producers are April Van Buren, Mike Blank, and Mercedes Mejia. And our fabulous interns include Leah Baldori, Catherine Newhan, Nell Ovett, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. Stay safe out there, and we'll catch you tomorrow.